From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Tracy McCray. In the fight against cancer, one of the most promising treatment advances is harnessing the power of the body's own immune system to fight the cancer. CAR T-cell therapy uses genetically modified versions of a patient's own immune cells to fight their cancer. These engineered cells multiply and act like a living drug that uses the body's own defense system to fight the disease. On today's program, we'll learn about CAR T-cell therapy from a Mayo Clinic expert. Also in the program, we'll learn about treating coronary artery disease and, just as important, tips for prevention, and how to help kids avoid common infections. All that, along with this week's health and medical news, right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Jake Strand.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
Chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy, more commonly known as CAR T-cell therapy, is one of the most promising breakthroughs in the treatment of some types of cancer. CAR T-cell therapy involves collecting a patient's white blood cells, or T-cells, and sending them to a central manufacturing facility where they're genetically modified to direct them against a patient's cancer.
It sounds like science fiction.
It is science fiction, but it's not fiction anymore,
Yeah,
Tracy.
That's right. Once they have been manufactured, the CAR T-cells are frozen and sent back to the hospital for IV infusion back into the patient. And here to help me understand, and more, hopefully, how this therapy works is Dr. Yi Lin. Dr. Lin is a hematologist and chair of the Cellular Therapeutics Cross-Disciplinary Group at Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. Welcome to the program, Dr. Lin.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. Yeah.
How in the world did we get to a place where what seems like science fiction is actually happening?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been a lot of excitement about this in the last few years in public media, from patients. But in reality, this technology has been in development for over 30 years, starting in the laboratory. And the very first generation of the CAR T didn't work very well. And so the version that we know of, we call second generation CAR T. It's a little bit like iPhones. We have all these different generations. But the generation that is that now we have the FDA approved CAR T, the first report of that working in a patient was in 2011. It was in a patient with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL. And so really in the last 6-7 years or so, there's been exponential growth in clinical research in this area. We've had now industry pharma company that got involved in pushing this trial to multi-center access for patients, to the point where as of late 2017, we had two CAR T product that's approved by the FDA to treat two different types of blood cancer. So a lot of growth and results in the last few years, but really this platform, this technology, really took 30 years or more to develop.
Well, and it has been in a lot of popular media. And so let maybe just break this down. So there's lots of different parts of the body that fight infection. So why T cells? Why not something else? What is it about the T cell that makes it important?
Yeah, when I explain this treatment to my patients, the comparison I make is the T cells are very much like the foot soldiers. So if you are, I know that's not necessarily the best analogy to use all the time in a battle, in a war, mm-hmm. trying to fight cancer, immune system is a big part of what can fight cancer that's supposed to be foreign, not supposed to live in our body. And there are types of immune cells that function more like generals that try to direct the actions. And then there are more immune cells that function more like the foot soldiers that actually does essentially the actual job of killing cancer cells. And so T cells is one type of white blood cells where one of their main functions is they can kill tumor cells. And so that's why, you know, there's certainly multiple cell-based and even drug approaches that try to activate different parts of the immune system. But T cell is certainly one type of blood cell that's been the focus of a lot of development. If you genetically program them to get them to do hopefully what they're normally supposed to do, but stronger, you can hopefully have that effect in terms of getting the tumor into remission and so on.
That's a fantastic way to describe it, to say that it's the foot soldier. Is there something in the works that's also like the general, so that the general does a better job of diagnosing or finding those cancer cells?
There are certainly approach is similar to that. So here, both at Mayo Clinic and as well in my own research program, there are challenges with each type of approaches. So one type of immune cells that I describe that has more of a general-like functions mm-hmm. are things like antigen-presenting cells. So dendritic cell vaccines is another approach that is part of our cellular therapy program. And we have a number of trials in solid tumors as well, not just in blood cancers, that look at that approach, because dendritic cells, essentially what they do is they try to educate a lot of T cells on what they need to attack. And so one dendritic cell can essentially activate hundreds, if not thousands, of T cells. So that's where that analogy comes from. Mm-hmm. However, all of these approaches, it's a tumor try to find ways to outsmart, you know, these approaches.
That's why it's a war.
We try to learn about that right. and figure out new technologies to overcome.
What patients end up using CAR T-cell therapy?
Right. So currently, for the FDA-approved indications, that's two different types of blood cancers. So one is in pediatrics, so children and young adult up to age 25 with B-cell acute leukemia, so B-cell ALL, and adults with B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and specific subsets of aggressive non-Hodgkin lymphoma, not all types of non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So we have two FDA-approved CAR-Ts looking at that can be used to treat those two diseases. It is not for frontline, so not for somebody who's just newly diagnosed with the treatment, but somebody who has these types of cancers, has had some of the conventionally available chemotherapy, immunotherapy drug, and it hasn't worked in that situation. But there's certainly a lot of research going on right now, both in those diseases, looking at can we use CAR T then earlier in the treatment options, as well as other types of cancers.
How are those cells, those T cells, removed from the patient? I mean, the person has cancer, but they still do have some T cells there. They're just not able to overcome the tumor and fight the cancer strongly enough. So they need to be bulked up with CAR T cell therapy.
Correct.
So how do you take those cells out?
So the patient is hooked up to a machine and undergo a procedure that we call leukapheresis. So leuke essentially means white blood cells. Apheresis, removing the white blood cells from the patient's body. Some of these patients may have gone through a treatment called stem cell transplant. And there, they're hooked up essentially to the same type of machine to remove their blood cell, except there, they may receive certain drugs to help move these stem cells that normally live in the bone marrow into the bloodstream for collection. Here, we don't need to give them these drugs. They should have adequate amount of white blood cells in the bloodstream. So it's a little bit more similar to, say, certain types of blood donations, where they're hooked up to a machine and certain parts of their blood are removed and the rest are put back in the body. Most of the time, and again, this can vary depending on the type of CAR T trials or the type of CAR T product they go through, but most of the time it's a one day or one time collection. So it's actually a half day, about four or five hour procedure.
And is this kind of thinking about the length of this? Is this something where now we've gotten to the point where the cells go off, they get modified, they get beefed up, and then brought back? Are patients in the hospital the whole time? Or are they coming back and forth depending on the type of treatment? What are we seeing now for most patients?
I imagine dramatic music is playing too.
Sometimes a patient feels a little anticlimactic after going through the whole process, and we come in, you know, with the cells ready to infuse. And if, particularly if they've had a stem cell transplant, and they look at the bag and it's not as big as the stem cell infusion, right. and they're like, "That's it. That's what we, you know,
there
that's what I've been
ceremony.
Working up to." Yeah. Exactly. And we try to warn them, well, maybe all the excitement is happening after the infusion. But you're right. This can be a very logistically challenging treatment. Because even a lot of references we make for the patients our stem cell transplant process, because many of them might have gone through that or was preparing for that, mm-hmm. and find out that they couldn't get this and now they need to look at CAR T treatment. But even then, even there, it's not quite the same. So for example, in stem cells, we're taking out the patient's own stem cells. We're not doing any further manipulation with the cells in the laboratory. These cells are ready to infuse back. So the patients pretty much can go on to the next portion of their treatment, which oftentimes is bigger dose of chemotherapy followed by stem cell infusion. Well, here we need to do that manufacturing in the lab, that genetic change of the T cells in the laboratory. And depending on the CAR T product or the technology, that can take anywhere from 2 weeks to 4 or 5 weeks.
Wow.
And that's a time frame where we know the patient had not, their cancer has been blowing through the treatment they've had up until then, and we still need to find ways to manage their cancer so that they're still healthy enough to get the CAR T cells once
they
they're
can
made.
Tolerate them. Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. And especially for our Rochester, Minnesota practice, we certainly have a number of patients that aren't necessarily coming from local. They might come from all over the country, even all over the world, to mm-hmm. get this treatment. And so what do they do in that 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks time in between? Oftentimes they go home. And so we were working with, for example, Center for Innovation to look at that process, that patient experience. How do we optimize that communication with the patient and also the home physician so they know what to watch for to stay in touch with us so we can manage any symptoms in a timely fashion? Because getting from collection to dosing is a real-world feasibility.
We've been talking about the exciting cancer treatment that uses the pain, the patient's own cells to attack the cancer. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Dr. Lin will discuss recovering from CAR T-cell therapy, what the results have shown, and what's next in research.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Jake Strand.
And I'm Tracy McRae. We've been talking with Mayo Clinic hematologist Dr. Yi Lin. Dr. Lin is chair of the Cellular Therapeutics Cross-Disciplinary Group at Mayo Clinic.
This is a lot to cover in a short period of time, but we've got a lot of really fascinating things to do in this world of CAR T. So we've talked about a bit how this gets done. You know, I think important to patient experience is not just the time it takes to get done, as you were bringing up, but also the recovery. So what kind of side effects can patients experience once they get to that anticlimactic piece about getting the small bag of T cells?
Then a lot of excitement happens.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons why CAR T therapy is not yet available just at any local oncology clinic.
Okay.
Multidisciplinary specialty care is needed because the fact that these CAR T cells goes back in the patient's body, they can find those tumors and become activated to try to kill the tumor. That same process of them becoming activated will cause the side effects that the patient experience. And what I try to warn people, and you can't quite prepare somebody well enough until they actually go through it,
mm-hmm.
is now you're going to experience side effects that's nothing like the chemotherapy so far.
Such as?
So the two most common ones we tell patients about are cytokine release syndrome and neurologic symptoms.
Say that first one again.
So cytokine release syndrome, or CRS, is essentially from the fact that when the CAR T cells are trying to kill the tumors, they're going to release all types of chemicals that they normally make inside their cells. They get released into that tumor environment to try to kill the tumor cells. So a lot of these are cytokines or chemokines. And those are the same type of chemicals that cause all the symptoms that you may experience when you have a really bad flu, mm-hmm. or a really bad pneumonia. And so that would start off with fever, and the fever curve can get really high,
sure.
40s, 41 degrees Celsius for days, and it may not break through with Tylenol anymore at some point. So this is what happens when you really genetically change and soup up, you know, your T cells to be super active.
And what about the neurological ones?
With the neurologic symptom, that's probably not quite as well understood in terms of why do people get them and who might get the more severe symptoms. We think, again, The most common presentation is within the same time frame of when patient experienced cytokine release syndrome, and therefore there's probably some relation to that immune activation. So perhaps somewhat similar to a viral meningitis type of picture. And so there the patients may initially have some confusion, difficulty finding words. It can progress to the point where they cannot communicate at all. And so when patients go through these symptoms, this is where they may even need ICU level monitoring. They need not only hematologists who's giving them this treatment, but good ICU doctors, good neurologists, cardiologists, infectious disease doctors, multidisciplinary team to support them through this time frame.
So to that point, that's why you need to be able, that's why that turnaround time is so important, and the ability to be at a center that has a high volume is so critical, so that you can, it's like you're taking patients to the brink and then trying to get them well enough again to see the results.
That is correct. I mean, this is a treatment that right now is being very tightly regulated, right, by the FDA and other organization that tries to monitor outcomes for cellular therapy, as we all learn how best to support patients through these treatments. Yeah.
You mentioned that you turn these CAR T cells into the foot soldiers that are all hyped up like superheroes. Do they get tired out and you need to put another batch of them in, or is this just a one-time thing?
Currently, we are treating patients with a one-time infusion and seeing how well does that work and how long does that work. There is opportunity if the patient had some response up front for a second treatment. But we are right now still trying to learn if this stops working, what the mechanism that it stops working. So is retreatment with CAR T again the right treatment option for them? And how well does it work the second time around? So yes, it is an option. It's not something that's being automatically done.
Are we going to be able to use CAR T cell for more types of cancers, or what's next in research?
There's a lot that's going on. Definitely a lot of clinical trials already looking at other types of cancers. So I definitely would encourage if a patient or their doctors at home has a type of cancer that hasn't responded well to other treatment options to explore what clinical trial testing is available at Mayo Clinic. We think multiple myeloma may very well be the next blood cancer that could have an FDA-approved indication if the trial continues to go as well as it has. And here at Mayo, we want to be the destination medical center for this type of, you know, very complex care that we excel at, where we have a number of different complex medical procedures and treatment where we not only have the best outcome in the country in terms of responses, you know, management of side effects, but also patient satisfaction. And so this is a type of treatment where we want to have that same outcome, which we've seen so far coming into clinical practice, which I'm not shy to brag about because it's the work of the entire team to be able to make that happen. But we also have a number of clinical trials, not only partnering with industry, but our in-house technology where we're looking at other types of cancer, how to give CAR T safer, so the next generation technology where we may not see as much side effects or we have smarter ways to manage the side effects, as well as even potentially using CAR T beyond cancer treatment.
We've been talking about the exciting new cancer treatment option, CAR T cell therapy, with Dr. Yi Lin, a hematologist and chair of the Cellular Therapeutics Cross-Disciplinary Group at Mayo Clinic Cancer Center. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Lin.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll discuss coronary artery disease with a Mayo Clinic expert.
And we'll learn how to help kids avoid those common infections. Coming up, the latest health and medical news with Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams for the Mayo Clinic News Network. For many people, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is a distressing and recurrent illness that affects breathing ability and quality of life. While treatable, COPD remains the third leading cause of death in the U.S. In the latest issue of Mayo Clinic Proceedings, researchers take a closer look at new findings and recommendations from the Global Initiative for Chronic Obstructive Lung Disease. Among the findings from the 2018 report are the following points. Influenza and pneumococcal vaccinations are recommended for patients with COPD. Treatments have been simplified. Other health conditions, particularly lung cancer and heart disease, play an important role in the health of those with COPD. Thus, prevention and vigilance against these conditions is important. The panel stresses the need for education, training, and assessments at every visit, especially with the often complex medication delivery devices that are part of treatments. Dr. Paul Scanlon says the majority of people with COPD have mild disease that requires very little treatment other than smoking cessation and possibly a short-acting bronchodilator. He says for the minority of people with more advanced disease, current therapy is very effective, improves symptoms and quality of life. It increases exercise tolerance and reduces frequency of exacerbations. So for current sufferers of COPD, there are ways to lower your risk and manage symptoms, including smoking cessation, regardless of how bad your lung function is. And in other news, polycystic kidney disease is one of the leading causes of kidney failure. So far, there has been no cure, says Dr. Fouad Shabib, a Mayo Clinic nephrologist. But for the first time, there is hope. A drug that the Food and Drug Administration recently approved for treating polycystic kidney disease. Now, polycystic kidney disease is caused by a genetic mutation passed down from parents. Patients will start forming kidney cysts, which are fluid-filled sacs in the kidney. The kidney starts to fill with fluids, leading to kidney failure. But there is hope for what has always been a difficult disease. Dr. Shabib, who was on the Mayo Clinic team researching the drug, says it's not a cure, but it can slow the disease's progression. And slowing the disease means patients won't need dialysis or need a transplant until they are much older. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Jake Strand.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Coronary artery disease is the most common type of heart disease in the United States. Coronary artery disease develops when the major blood vessels that supply your heart with blood, oxygen, and nutrients become damaged or diseased. Cholesterol-containing deposits like plaques in your arteries are usually to blame.
When those plaques build up, the narrowing of your coronary artery decreases blood flow to your heart. And I'm no medical expert, but I know that can't be good. The result is symptoms including chest pain and shortness of breath. A complete blockage can lead to a heart attack. Here to discuss treatment and prevention of coronary artery disease is Mayo Clinic cardiologist and the former chair of cardiovascular medicine at Mayo Clinic, Dr. Chet Rehal. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Rehal. Chet.
Thank you for having me back. It's
great
always
to have you.
A pleasure to be here with you.
I don't even know how many times you have come in to talk with us about coronary artery disease. Why, first of all, are so many people interested in this?
And the reason is pretty simple. It's very common. In fact, heart disease is still the number one killer in America. Cancer is a very close second. It's sort of neck and neck, I'm afraid, between these two. Heart disease is almost ubiquitous after a certain age, okay? So the older we get, the more likely we are to have heart disease. And if we have risk factors on top of that, you know, whether it's diabetes, smoking, God forbid, hypertension, high blood pressure, high cholesterol in the blood, all of these things increase the risk of us developing blockages in our arteries. We've made tremendous progress in treating and preventing coronary disease over the past 40, 50 years. Since the Surgeon General's report in 1963 that outlined smoking as a risk factor, the rates of smoking, high blood pressure have gone down, and the overall risk and incidence of heart attacks has gone down. And when the public smoking bans came in, that also made it go further down. And on top of that, we have very good treatments, balloons, stents, bypass surgeries, and new medications. All of those things have really, really helped. However, all of those things are treatments. They don't actually prevent the problem in the first place. So we have a lot of good treatments. However, it's best never to get the disease in the first place.
Those risk factors that people hear about, there's also a lot of warning signs that might trigger someone to get further evaluation. What are some of those warning signs that we should be aware of?
Yeah. So the things to watch out for, and that's really your question. Typically, what people will walk or exert themselves, if they get any unusual symptoms in the chest, that could be a warning sign. the classic symptom, which is sort of the elephant sitting on the chest, you know, the heaviness, that can occur typically in males. Many women don't experience that. And in women, it can present in more unusual ways. It can be sharp pains. It may be at rest sometimes. But any unusual symptoms in the chest area, sometimes even in the neck area, can be a sign. Shortness of breath can occur as well without the chest pain. So there's lots of different things.
You're talking about emergency department, though, type of warning signs. What are some of the warning signs before that?
So even before that, if people are fatigued, they're getting short of breath, their exercise tolerance is not the same as before, those things could be a sign that you may need to get evaluated for some sort of heart disease. And that evaluation can be simple. It can be on an outpatient basis. It starts with a good history and physical by a good doctor, right? And following maybe a stress test of something of some sort. That can give us a lot of key information as to whether or not there are serious underlying problems.
What is actually happening to your heart? Is it getting harder? Is it getting gunked up? What's happening? Yeah.
So we literally have buildup and deposits of stuff within the arteries. The way I explain it to my patients is the arteries are like a pipe. And the role of the arteries is to deliver blood down to the heart muscle, right? So you can get all sorts of plaque building up in your arteries just like you can in your plumbing at home. They can be focal plaques that are short and that can be treated with balloons and stents, or they can be more diffuse plaque. For example, like diabetic patients sometimes get where the entire pipe gets narrower and narrower. And if you look inside these plaques, what do we see? We see cholesterol deposits. We see calcium built up. Right, and we see other types of things, and there are like specific cells that can build up in there. Sometimes we see blood clots or healing blood clots also within these plaques. So they're very complex. It's not just cholesterol, but it's many different things. And one of the risk factors that we're finding more recently is inflammation in these arteries. So just like you can get inflammation on your skin or in your lungs or anywhere else, you can actually get inflammation involving the arteries of your heart. And that's a really important risk factor.
Well, and you mentioned the buildup. So that's really what people are targeting when you mentioned stents and other interventions. When people have a loved one who might have gone through this or you know is at risk for this, what sort of progress have we made in making sure that those types of procedures are available to people in a rapid fashion? I remember when I was in training, you know, it was all about door-to-balloon time or how quickly can you get somebody into the cath lab for one of these procedures. What sort of progress have we made for people not just in urban areas but across the country?
So this is a great question. So we and many others around the country have developed not just rapid cath lab access from our own emergency department, but we've truly developed regional systems of care. So for example, here at Mayo Clinic, we have up around 30 hospitals in our region throughout Minnesota that are involved in our so-called STEMI network, which means acute heart attack. And so what would happen is if a patient shows up at one of our regional partner hospitals, okay, depending on when they show up in relation to their symptoms, they may get a drug to open up the blockage, or they may get sent here right away in a helicopter right to the cath lab for us to open up the acute blockage. So we really are able to blanket most of southern Minnesota and provide rapid access to the cath lab and emergency care. And there's a couple of other very good programs in Minnesota. So we're very fortunate in this state that virtually the entire state is now covered by rapid access care for acute heart attack victims.
Since this program, though, is over 200 radio stations, I would imagine then if living in Minnesota is a good place to live, there might be other parts of the country that are not good places to live, relatively speaking, when it comes to coronary artery disease.
Yeah, I don't know about the coverage from cath labs around the country, but you're right, is that there is tremendous variation from state to state and region to region in the incidence of coronary disease. And a lot of it can be traced back to some of the basic risk factors. So if you look at the rates of obesity and diabetes, they kind of exactly mirror the rates of coronary disease. And so where do we see the most? If you look at the map, it's up the Mississippi River Valley and then up into the southeast. This is where the highest rates of all of these conditions are in the U.S. So we have a lot more work to do nationally. In Minnesota, again, which is where we're based, we're relatively fortunate in having relatively low rates of these things. They're a lot higher in other parts of the country.
Well, and I think you mentioned this idea of lifestyle prevention. And then when you notice some of these warning signs, or even when you are diagnosed with a condition that puts you at risk, really making sure that you have access to good medical facilities so you can keep a close eye on it sounds like a critical part of that care.
We have about 30 seconds left. What are some other tips for prevention of coronary disease?
You know, just, it's actually quite simple. You don't need a cardiologist to tell you what to do. Lead a healthy lifestyle, be active, get up off the sofa, put the remote away, put the phone away, be active, keep your weight under control. That's the single biggest driver. Excess weight drives high blood pressure, high blood cholesterol, and high blood sugar. Keep the weight under control, be active. Chances are you're going to do much better.
We've been talking about coronary artery disease with Mayo Clinic cardiologist Dr. Chet Rehal. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll discuss kids and common infections with a Mayo Clinic infectious disease expert. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Jake Strand.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Infections are a normal part of childhood. According to the American Academy of Pediatrics, most children will have 6 to 8 respiratory infections each year. These include colds, ear infections, sinus infections, bronchitis, and pneumonia. Infections that cause diarrhea and or vomiting are also very common, as any parent can tell you.
Some of the best kind of
Absolutely.
Infections. When children are together in close quarters, such as a childcare setting or in school, infections are more easily spread from one child to another. So how can we help our kids avoid those nasty bugs that are going around? Here to discuss kids, infections, and what to do about them is Mayo Clinic infectious disease specialist, Dr. Nipuni Rajapakse. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Rajapakse. It's great to have you here.
It's great. Thanks for having me back.
Both Dr. Strand and I, kids in daycare. Mine are no longer in daycare.
Mine are
Yours
almost
are
done.
In daycare. I think it's the best thing ever because they have gotten all of those bugs out of their system, and my kids have not been sick ever since they were in daycare. Am I imagining that, or is that for real?
So kids are exposed to a lot of different types of infections in daycare, for sure. And by virtue of that, parents are often exposed to a lot of infections during that phase of life as well. So there are many infections. When you get infected with them once, you develop some level of immunity to them. And so it does kind of help to stimulate a child's immune system to be exposed to all those infections.
So I'm not imagining it.
Nope.
It doesn't make it less of frustrating, though. I mean, I guess one of the things I'm curious about are what are the most common infections that kids are getting?
Sure. So there's things that circulate kind of during different times of year. By far the most common infection would be the common cold, which we see kind of happen year-round. Common cold is caused by a variety of different viruses, actually over 100 different viruses, and that's why it is so common. As I mentioned, you can get some level of immunity to things you've been exposed to in the past, but when there's so many different viruses out there, there's a lot of different things that can circulate it in different places and over time.
What is the difference between a viral and a bacterial infection? Because the only reason it makes a difference, as far as I'm concerned as the parent, is do they get antibiotics or not?
Sure. So that's kind of one of the important distinguishing features. So viruses are tiny microscopic particles that we can't see. They can cause a whole variety of different types of infections. Some mild, like the common cold, but also more serious things like brain infections. As well. And so there's a large spectrum of diseases that we see caused by viruses. Bacteria are also microscopic, so you can't see them with the naked eye. And they too can cause a variety of infections ranging from harmless to quite serious and harmful, sometimes even leading to death. And so the main thing when it comes to treatment is whether or not they will respond to antibiotics. Viruses do not respond to antibiotics, only bacterial infections do. And as we're learning more and more about some of the harmful effects of antibiotics and running into more and more problems with antibiotic resistance, that differentiation becomes more and more important.
Do you think it's the case, because I hear this from fellow parents and family members, that it seems more and more we're hearing about the problems of overprescription of antibiotics. Is that because kids are generally getting more commonly viral infections? Would that be a fair statement, or is that overstating it?
So we do see a lot of antibiotic prescriptions being written for things that are viral infections and for which there are no benefits. It's one of the biggest kind of drivers of the overprescribing of antibiotics. It can be challenging in some situations when you have a patient in front of you to say for sure whether it's a virus or a bacteria. Kids are exposed to both frequently during childhood. But we really want to get away from using antibiotics in kids who have a viral syndrome or viral infection just because it's of no benefit to them and can cause harm.
Are parents not surprised by that as much as they used to be?
Yeah, I think now parents have access to so much information. I think a lot of them are very aware about the issues of resistance and some of the impact of antibiotics on things like, for example, the microbiome. So we know that our body is made up of all sorts of good bacteria, And when you give someone antibiotics, along with wiping out harmful bacteria, you also wipe out some of the good bacteria. And so now I'm hearing a lot more from parents who are saying, oh, does my child really need an antibiotic for this, more so than in the past, coming in and sometimes asking or demanding from a doctor to have an antibiotic for their child. And so I think all this new information and knowledge that we're getting, we're starting to kind of see the tides change a bit.
Well, and I think that leads to the next question. So if you don't get antibiotics, because you know a lot of these syndromes are potentially viral, what sort of things can you do to help kids get healthy, and how do you help keep them from spreading it to other kids?
Sure, that's a great question. Kids can feel very miserable when they have a viral infection. It's not like just because it's a virus, it's just a mild infection and they necessarily feel fine. But there are a lot of things that we can advise that can help them feel better. One of the things is using medications like acetaminophen or ibuprofen if they're having fever or feeling uncomfortable.
Wait a second. I thought that you're supposed to kind of let the fever be, because it's there for a reason. And unless it's really high, you should just kind of let the fever be to burn away whatever it's there for.
Yes. So that's why I said if they're feeling uncomfortable. That was okay. The key part of that sentence.
All
right. So you don't need to treat fever if the child is happy, playing, running around, looks perfectly fine. There's no reason to give them any specific medication for the fever itself. But if they're feeling kind of crummy or they're tired or not feeling well, they're not wanting to eat or drink, those are reasons why you might want to give them something so they feel a bit better.
But is it okay to leave that fever unchecked, to not treat it with medication if they are feeling okay? It's okay.
Yeah, so the most important thing when we hear about or see kids with fever, I think some people get quite fixated on the numbers of the fever and how high it is. But for us, really the most important thing is how the child looks. And so if they're running around playing, eating and drinking fine, I'm less concerned about that child, even though they might have a really high number on the thermometer, as opposed to the child who might have a lower grade fever but is lethargic, sleepy, difficult to wake, not eating and drinking.
All right, so I interrupted you. So we've got the fever. What are some other things you can do to help them?
Sure. So aside from things like acetaminophen and ibuprofen, you can use warm drinks or cool drinks. A lot of kind of common cold or even influenza, things like that, are associated with some sore throat. And so in terms of also keeping them hydrated, those kinds of things can be helpful. Popsicles, another good thing. The most important thing when kids are sick is making sure that they stay hydrated. They may not want to eat much, which I think is fine for a few days until they recover, but getting as much fluids as you can into them as possible is super important. And so sometimes things like popsicles can both soothe the throat and also give extra fluids. The other big thing is kind of doing what you can to avoid transmission. So obviously in a household setting, especially if you have multiple kids at home, especially young kids, it can be hard. But making sure that everyone's washing their hands, practicing good cough etiquette. So by that, we mean coughing or sneezing into your elbow, disposing of tissues and things, washing your hands really well. As simple as it sounds is really the number one thing that we recommend.
So the funny thing is it hasn't changed much. I feel like I just read a Berenstain Bear book to my kids like a year ago, from published in the 70s, about how Papa was doing a terrible job and not coughing into his arm. And it feels like we still keep telling people over and over again, but it's still really important. We still need to wash our hands and make sure that we're working on preventing transmission. I mean, that seems to be the huge issue that is over and over again and can't be emphasized enough.
Yeah, so I would say the kind of two biggest things, wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands, is huge. And then vaccines is the other big thing we can do to prevent some of these common infections in kids.
And finally, how long are kids contagious, or adults for that matter? How long should we stay home from work? How long should they stay out of school?
Yeah, so that's a complicated question. Depends a bit on what the actual infection is. For many common infections, the time that you transmit the most is usually the time that you have fever for. And so that's kind of a general rule, is if you're having fever, you're probably shedding virus in your saliva and in your secretions and can transmit. But certain conditions like stomach flus can be transmitted for longer, even after your symptoms, vomiting, diarrhea, have resolved. And so it's an important thing to talk to your doctor about when you see them, so they can guide you a bit on when it may be safe to go back.
Well, thank you so much for being here. We've been talking about kids and infections with Mayo Clinic infectious disease specialist, Dr. Napuni Rajapakse. Thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Rajapakse.
Great. Thanks for having me.
And that's our program for this week.
For more information about topics discussed today, visit us on the web at Mayo Clinic News Network, where you can access a podcast of today's show, previously aired programs, and the latest news from Mayo Clinic.
Have a question about health and medicine for one of our Mayo Clinic experts? Tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Jacob Strand.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.